One of the marks of Western culture at the moment is a distinct slowing of momentum. I think the reason for this is the three trends which have been working out in our culture have all come together and converged. And as they've done so, this has formed a kind of vacuum of thought and a vacuum of effective answer. And people are wondering where exactly we're going to go next. Now, the fact that we have a vacuum and something of a lull means we've got a real chance to reconsider where we are in terms of the Western progress. But on the other hand, many people realize that unless we answer the questions raised by this vacuum, then what we're going to do once we come out of it is just to accelerate into a world which has been prophesied in terms of the Brave New World and so on. Now, the three factors, the three trends are this. The first and the longest of them has been the erosion of the Christian culture. An erosion with very long historical roots, but clearly visible results today. Clearly, the Western Europe and America, which was once a Christian culture, has had its entire Christian basis eroded and undermined. So that all that's remaining is a lingering memory in terms of morals and ways of doing things. That's the first trend. The second trend, though, is the failure of humanism. In other words, when Christianity was pushed on one side, humanism, and specifically optimistic humanism, was seen as the answer, the alternative, providing the morals, the ethical ideals, etc., to really take over the leadership of Western culture. But what we're very much seeing now is what Sartre calls, and what I want to lecture on this afternoon, the striptease of humanism. In other words, the failure of humanism to provide a credible alternative to the leadership of the Western world. And the third trend is the efforts of our generation to provide an alternative to both the first and the second. In other words, the story of the counterculture. But as many, many people are saying now, what we're seeing once again is as another failure, the abortion of the counterculture. So as these three come together, you see there's a real vacuum that it's not clear where we should be going next. The erosion of the Christian culture, the crisis of humanism, and the abortion of the counterculture. And so there's a sense of a lack of effective thought and action right at the moment. And you can see this in many areas. And as I say, this gives us a good opportunity to rethink where we are as men and where our culture is heading. But on the other hand, if this opportunity is not taken, then surely there's no alternative but to accelerate into something that goes towards the outlines of the Brave New World. Today I'd like to look at the second of those, humanism and the crisis of humanism today, under this title which Sartre has given it, The Striptease of Humanism. But first of all, let's go back and really appreciate and understand the rise of optimistic humanism and appreciate it at its best. We can't understand this unless we see something of its historical background. Some people see the forerunners of modern humanism to be those branches of Buddhism and Confucianism which remove any need for religion. And it's true, back in China and in the early parts of India, you have both these areas of Buddhism and Confucianism which are basically humanist, removing any ideas of religious origins and so on and explaining man in terms of his own possibilities. But the first real milestone on the journey to modern humanism in the West is 5th century Greece. This is the first time in Europe where the use of objective reason freed science and philosophy from the shackles of religious superstition. The first milestone. Now, as you know, the Golden Age of Greece was brief but glorious, and its influence cast a long shadow down over the Roman Empire and throughout the classical world. Yet when Islam came and barbarism, except for a few small pockets of scholars, the Golden Age of classical Greece was swept from the face of Europe. The second important milestone on the road to modern humanism was the Renaissance, when suddenly the importance of man erupted on the Western scene and damaged for all time the medieval web, which had seen an intricate balance of man and nature. The Renaissance was an intoxicating brand of humanism, an explosive confidence believing in the human mind, the celebration of art and morals and thought and life on an eminently human scale. The Renaissance was Christendom's twilight toast to the dignity and excellence of man by himself. People in the Renaissance made flattering comparisons of themselves to Republican Rome and to the Athens of Pericles and so on. But the idea was that borrowing all the age of classicism, they would make man the only scale they saw. As Protagoras said, man is the measure of all things. And as an early Renaissance thinker put it in his own terms, a man can do all things if he will. This is really the birth of modern humanism. And this is the time during the Renaissance that the word humanist was coined. Initially, it only defined a concern for humanity. In fact, many of these early humanists saw no dichotomy at all between this and their Christian faith, and they were very religious. Yet it was from the Renaissance that modern secular humanism has grown, because out of the Renaissance became a very important split between reason and religion. And this occurred as the Roman Catholic Church's complacent authority was exposed in two very vital areas. The first was science, where Galileo, in the name of reason, supported the Copernican Revolution and upset the Roman Catholic Church's adherence to the theories of Aristotle and exposed them as false. The second split came in the area of theology, where the Dutch humanist scholar Erasmus, with his new text, his new Greek text of the Bible, showed that the Roman Catholic adherence to Jerome's Vulgate was frequently in error. Two tiny areas, science and theology. But in these, a tiny wedge was forced between reason and authority as the Roman Catholic Church then understood it. And this is basically how the Renaissance proceeded. On the one hand, a forward-looking stance through science, and on the other hand, a backward-looking glance at classicism, made possible through all the new sources of the Greek texts and so on. And this is where the Renaissance found its leading intellectual impetus. The art historian of the Renaissance, Vasari, put it like this, asking himself why it was that it was in Florence that men became perfect in the arts. He gave us his first answer, the spirit of criticism. Looking forward to science and reason and looking back to the Greeks, this is the great ideal, the spirit of criticism. So reason applied to every area of life, undermining all authority which didn't have a true basis. It was this same spirit of criticism which continued to gather force until it broke over Europe like a landslide of unbelief. As the dust settled, this ensuing period was described as the Enlightenment, the 18th century ferment of thought and action, which is the third great milestone on the road to modern humanism. The Enlightenment has a real affinity with the Renaissance. Both the men of the Enlightenment and the Renaissance appealed directly to classical antiquity as their source, deliberately opposed Christianity, and consequently accelerated the forces of modernity. But the Enlightenment, with the advantage of distance, could afford to view the Middle Ages through the eyes of the Renaissance. So there was a detachment and an objectivity impossible for the earlier humanists. Sometimes the Renaissance humanists proclaimed a new world only because they knew that the old world was irretrievable. But for the men of the Enlightenment, there wasn't just despair at a new world, but the joy because of the triumphs of the results of the scientific intellect. If the legacy of the Renaissance was humanism, then the contribution of the Enlightenment is paganism, modern paganism. The 18th century Enlightenment came in on a wave of irony and satire, exalting the trivial, ridiculing the noble, and attacking everything which previous centuries had been taught to believe and revere and love. It was a heyday for the critics. But the chief influence of the critics did not lie with the popular writers like Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels, but rather with the so-called philosophes, the philosophers, the articulate, sociable, secular men of letters who were the heart and soul of the Enlightenment. Towards the end of the Enlightenment, in 1784, Immanuel Kant defined the Enlightenment as the period of man's emergence from his self-imposed minority. And he offered as the motto of the Enlightenment, "Dare to know." And it was certainly in following this challenge that the powerful combination of British empiricism and French rationalism changed the whole face of Europe. As this occurred, the break between reason on the one hand and revelation on the other hand was finalized. And from then on, the battle was joined in terms of the Hellene versus the Hebrew, light versus darkness, reason versus superstition, philosopher versus priest, and men of realism versus purveyors of myth. In this battle between the church and reason, the evidence of the classical age was far more than antiquarian. The ancients were crucial as signposts to secularism. As the Enlightenment philosophers saw it, they were throwing a bridge across the miasmal fog of the Christian centuries and attempting to bring back over the greatest prize of all, the spirit of criticism again, same cry. Their pride in the omnicompetence of reason was by no means the assertion that reason was all-powerful. Rather, it was the bold demand, born of an anti-authoritarian attitude, that they had the right to use reason to question anything at all. Of course, as time went on, the questions became more and more far-reaching, and the criticisms more uncompromising. In the early stages, many of the leading philosophers were deists, arguing against theism from a rigid concept of natural law which excluded God. In the end, they were atheists, using the arguments of utilitarianism. Sadly, within the church itself, where there was spiritual life, it was often inward-looking pietism with no cultural cutting edge. And where there was no spiritual life, which is very often the case, the bankruptcy was not decently disguised, but brazenly advertised by a suicidal mixture of struggles, bland theologies, and dull apologetics. Remember the famous statement of one of the philosophers who said that he'd never ever questioned the existence of God until one of the Christian apologists of his day started to defend it. And this is typical of the very poor apologetics of the day. Little wonder that it could be said for men like David Hume, religion has lost all specificity and authority. It is no more than a dim, meaningless, and unwelcome shadow on the face of reason. Certainly, as the 18th century came to a close, all the wisdom and all the wit apparently lay on the side of the Enlightenment. Man was demanding to be recognized as an adult, a responsible being. And there's no denying that this was a momentous stage in the journey of the Western mind. The 18th century went out amid wars of revolution, and the 19th century was ushered in by the campaigns of Napoleon. If to the perceptive this was symptomatic of the hidden logic of romanticism, of humanism, to most men it was only a sign that an age of ideas was ripening into an age of application. Man was not only the measure of the world he knew, but the measure of the world of which he dreamed. Relying on the application of reason and science, the 19th century looked forward to a rich fund from which to draw for its buoyant idealism and its robust social enterprise. In the 19th century, if there was any lingering doubt as to whether or not philosophy had transferred its support from theology to humanism, this was dispelled finally for most people when the mechanistic worldview of science provided an explanation of the origins and development of the universe. Astronomy and physics had already removed any need for God as a scientific hypothesis. But the turning point came in the 19th century when biology added its own explanation. At one time, at one stroke, the evolutionary theory appeared to demolish Christianity and provide a scientific basis for the philosophy of progress that was already widely being held. Technically, Darwin was not the originator of the idea of evolution. Rather, he was the first to give the theory its scientific mechanism as a basis. So if you could have seen things at the end of the 19th century, what you would have seen was a series of whirlpools with many strange currents and cross-currents. From one side of the spectrum of the religious thinking at this time came the rise of higher criticism, undermining the Bible, and liberal theology. And from the other side of the religious spectrum came an extremely reactionary entrenchment within the church. This is the time, for instance, the Roman Catholics promulgated the doctrine of papal infallibility in 1870. While in England, Bishop Wilberforce achieved a great degree of notoriety in his debate with Huxley. And this period on the religious side also saw the appearance of various semi-religions like the Church of Christ Scientist and the Theosophical Society. And it was at the same time, out of this welter and ferment of ideas, at the same time, on the secular front, that you had the real birth of modern humanism in the form of the humanist societies. In 1896, the Ethical Union was founded to federate all the humanist rationalist societies. And in 1899, the Rationalist Press was founded to propagate these in a larger way. Now, it's certainly true that both of these and all of the others remained comparatively small until humanism suddenly popularized in the mid-1950s. And probably the effect was that the World War II just blew apart the remaining fabric of the Christian culture. The erosion of the Christian culture had taken all these centuries to build up. But suddenly World War II just undermined the remaining fabric, and the logic showed through, and suddenly there's a flowering of humanism once again. In 1963, these various groups merged to form in Britain the British Humanist Association. And together they linked with a wider international humanist and ethical union. And as this happened, this marks the fourth milestone on the journey to modern optimistic humanism. 5th century BC Greece, 15th century Renaissance, The 18th century Enlightenment, and here the 20th century secular humanism. Well, looked at another way, you could say that after the first slow stage of cosmic evolution, inorganic evolution, had come the second stage of biological evolution, organic. But now, as they say, this is as the humanists put it, with the universe decreated, a phrase of Simone Weil's, and the West unchristened, a phrase of C.S. Lewis's, the third stage could now begin, the stage of what they call purposive psychosocial evolution. "We're storming the gates of heaven," cried a German socialist, Karl Liebknecht, at the end of World War I. But today he needn't bother. For most people, heaven has long since been evacuated, and man has come of age, and this is the dominant modern tone. "Man can now make himself," says Gordon Child. "We see the future of man as one of his own making," says H.J. Muller. And Sir Julian Huxley put it like this. Today in the 20th century, man, the evolutionary process is at last becoming conscious of itself. Human knowledge, worked over by human imagination, is seen as the basis to human understanding and belief, and the only ultimate guide to human progress. Sometimes you look back and it looks as if the earlier days of secularism almost represent a belligerent, all-out anti-God campaign. And a typical text of these days would be Swinburne's famous Hymn of Man, "Glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of things." But far more typical of modern humanism, which is far more urbane and self-assured, would be John Kennedy's reputed dictum, "All men's problems were created by man, and I am certain they can be solved by man." If you look around today, the modern humanist at his best is a man who's highly educated, deeply aware, very tolerant and far-sighted. He has clearly defined policies, and he's very confident that his philosophy is a relevant way of life, and he is extremely determined to communicate it on every way he can. The mid-1960s were the high noon of this optimistic humanism. In England, the British Humanist Association had a whole series of distinguished presidents, Sir Julian Huxley and Professor Sir Alfred Eyre among them. And underneath these presidents, a whole dazzling array of intellectual representation. And they suddenly blossomed in public influence and political activity. Around them, the new universities suddenly mushroomed like institutional tracts, erected on the same beliefs. For instance, all the modern universities in England, there's no religion allowed on campus, and they all are founded with specifically humanist aims. But above all, the crowning proof of man's capability seemed to be the triumph of the moon landing and the space research. The gigantic satellite launching towers were hailed by many humanists as the modern technological cathedrals, but built this time to the glory of modern man. In other words, optimistic humanism gained its strength from the confidence that the entire field of human development was now possible within the humanist frame. Julian Huxley went so far as to claim that every problem could be solved by humanism, and that the whole range of human living could be included within this frame. Huxley predicted that philosophical problems like mind against matter, or social problems like the clash of the two cultures, or even international problems such as war could be solved by humanism. Humanism, he said, quote, would heal the split between the two sides in the Cold War. Huxley also included a new concept of religion, distinctively humanist because it's a religion without revelation that was divine. Maybe you know that in the 19th century, Auguste Comte, the French positivist, had proposed a religion of humanity, complete with his own type of humanist sacraments, saints, and rituals, organized into a European network of 2,000 churches with Comte himself as the leader, very similar to a kind of humanist pope. Huxley's version today is far less papal and more in line with the urbanity of modern humanism. Religion, Huxley says, is probably necessary, but instead of worshipping supernatural rulers, it will sanctify the higher manifestations of human nature in art and love, and in intellectual comprehension and aspiring adoration. And in the humanist frame, you really have humanism at its highest and its most hopeful, attempting literally to solve all problems and include the whole of human living within its framework, and by this to guide the progress and guard the evolution of the human race by its own purposive action. So that for the first time, man takes the center of the evolutionary stage and now is not the product of evolution, but is the arbiter of his own destiny as he controls his own evolution. The third stage, purposive, psychosocial evolution. Time, however, is gradually and cynically stripping this to its essential quaintness. Only the cold-blooded technocrat finds modern war any less chilling, or its solution any nearer. The ideal that Huxley speaks of human nature sanctified in humanist art, was already falsified, faltering under the sunken stare of the alienated Giacometti bronzes, or strangled by the cries from the tortured canvases of Francis Bacon. And both these men were humanists, but they were into a very different world. In other words, what we've seen just in the few years since Huxley wrote is that optimistic humanism is in the process of being betrayed by its own idealism. The humanist artists, as its antennae, were already into a world which the optimistic philosophers and scientists had not yet seen. And as with all idealism, the tragedy of them is the blindness of their heroes. They were tuned into a world of illusions. They were only too vulnerable to reality. So here's the first section, then, the rise of optimistic humanism. Now, secondly, I'd like to look at the second section, the surfacing of pessimism. The surfacing of pessimistic humanism. Now we can see an important point very clearly. Optimistic humanism is only one stream of secular humanism. And the reverse side of optimistic humanism is the pessimistic variety. If the optimism was characteristically strong in academic circles, it's now evident that pessimism was more prevalent in the wider reality of life. In other words, even when the optimism was there, pessimism was also there, like a subterranean stream, murky in its depths and dark in its apprehension of the dilemmas facing them. But it's this subterranean stream that is now threatening to surface and usurp the dignity and the dominance of optimistic humanism. So let's look into this eruption of pessimism in our own time. Again, we must go back in history to realize the full importance of the pessimistic humanism. Its genius has been to see that behind the apparent stability of the 19th century world in which modern humanism was born stood a very different reality. Both Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and people like themselves were men who lived in passionate revolt against the smugness of the Victorian world, and particularly against the cheapness of its religious faith and the brash confidence of its secular reasoning, or generally against the 19th century's shallow optimism and its wordy idealism and its tendency to conform on every level. For Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, such a world was not just smug, but it was false and dangerously foolish, because the true nature of reality lay elsewhere. Now, of course, as we see it now, it's amazing that such subterranean pessimism was not taken seriously more earlier. And one wonders why. For example, it was laughed away and derided as the devil's party, in quotes. In other words, the poets, the philosophers, the prophets, who looked at chaos and catastrophe and calamity, and as such they were all too easy to dismiss because the world wasn't that bad at the time. They were ignored for various reasons. For example, one group of the so-called Devil's Party was ignored because their warnings were just relegated to the level of a cultural myth, because they were poetic. For example, back in 1832, Heinrich Heine, the German poet, had said, "Can you hear the little bell tinkle? Kneel down. They're bringing sacraments to a dying God." And Nietzsche later made the great cry, "In the modern world there is no aim, no answer to the question why, and man has lost all dignity in his own eyes." But things like this were not taken seriously. After all, wasn't Heine a poet? And wasn't Nietzsche later deranged? And so they were just put into a kind of cultural limbo. On the other hand, other warnings were dismissed because they were only to be expected because of the temperament or the theory of the particular author. Repeatedly in the 1930s, George Orwell depicted the Western intellectuals as men who in blithe ignorance were soaring off the very branch on which they were sitting. Or Malcolm Muggeridge in his articles in the 20s and 30s kept on trying to lance open the death wish of liberalism. Or C.S. Lewis made careful exposures in articles like The Funeral of a Great Myth, speaking about evolution. But But the serious disquiet of Orwell, or the humorous and testy honesty of Muggeridge, and the gentle clarity and utter reasonableness of C.S. Lewis were before their time. They were dismissed. They were predictable. They were ignored. But the point where we are today is that the rising tide of disquiet can no longer be ignored. It's becoming the accepted mood of much recent judgment. For example, writing in 1961, specifically in The Problems of Western Culture, Fanon marked, "Look at them today," speaking of Western humanists, "swaying between atomic and spiritual disintegration." And writing in the same context, Jean-Paul Sartre challenged, "Let us look at ourselves if we can really bear to and see what's becoming of us. And first, we must face that unexpected revelation, the striptease of our humanism." Now, of course, you could dismiss these two men as pessimistic and radical. In other words, politically prejudiced and philosophically offbeat. But it's not just with the pessimists and the radicals that the disquiet ends. Coming much closer to the heart of humanism, in fact, speaking almost as an heir to perhaps the most distinguished house of humanism, the Huxley family, Aldous Huxley spoke of himself like this: "I was born wandering between two worlds, one dead and the other powerless to be born. And I've made in a curious way the worst of both." Or from the world of science, and a man who's still alive today, John Rader Platt, the American biophysicist, says, "The world has now become too dangerous for anything less than utopia." Or to take a man who's famous for his romanticism, his lyrical romanticism, Norman O'Brown, very popular in the counterculture, says, "Today, even the survival of humanity is a utopian hope." In other words, what we've seen is optimistic humanism suddenly threatened by the surfacing of pessimism. And there can be no stable equilibrium between optimism and pessimism again. And what you see today is this uneasy oscillation between the two. Optimistic humanism is strong in its stress in the aspirations, the good parts of man, but it's weak in its understanding of his aberrations and weaknesses. Accordingly, it lacks a basis for the fulfillment of the aspirations, and it lacks any solution to the latter. On the other hand, pessimistic humanism insists on the absurdity of man's aspirations and speaks to the heart of its aberrations. But the price of its realism is that if you follow it, you're constantly pulled down towards despair. And this is the uneasy oscillation, caught between an optimism without a basis and a pessimism that verges on despair. This clear contrast throws further light on the current crisis. Optimistic humanism is being exposed as idealism without sufficient ideals. More accurately, its ideals are impossible to attain without a sufficient basis in truth. And this is just what its rationalistic premises are unable to provide. And this is the key weakness in each of four areas which are central pillars of optimistic humanism. We'll look at these four areas: reason, etc., etc. And you'll see that in each of these three areas, optimistic humanism says the right things but has no basis for saying them. And so when the crunch comes, it's left as an optimism without any basis. The first pillar of optimistic humanism is belief in reason. In other words, that without revelation or without God, man, with the use of science and his unaided reason, can do it within the humanist frame. This is the first place that optimistic humanism is forced to its first leap of faith. It is impossible to prove by reason alone that reason has the validity accorded to it by humanism. In fact, the 20th century has heavily undermined the role of reason at two important points. First of all, psychology, and second, philosophy. Psychology has shown that far from being utterly rational, man has motivations at a deeper level than reasoning, of which he's only partially aware. In fact, much which we call reasoning is actually just rationalizing. Philosophy has been the second area where reason has been undermined. For modern man to speak from a finite reference point without divine revelation and to claim to have found a universal, which you would need for rationalism to succeed, is not just mistaken, it's meaningless. And that's why for most modern men, objectivity and universal and absolutes are in a realm totally beyond reason. And all we're left with in this realm is the existential, the non-rational, the subjective, and so on. Thus, both psychology and philosophy have clipped the proud wings of rationalism and the unlimited usefulness of reason by itself. And it's funny that a rationalistic age like ours, in many ways, is the most irrational age for many centuries. So the basis of reason is gone, the first pillar of optimistic humanism. The second pillar is their belief in progress. The orientation towards the future, which is introduced into Western culture by Christian teleology, was secularized at the time of the Enlightenment. In other words, Christians believed in this progress towards a great future because God was going to do something at the end of history. At the Enlightenment, they ruled out God and they said man would do something. So man now worked towards his own utopian future. Of course, they claimed too that this was given objective scientific support by the evolutionary theory. And it was widely believed that nature was marching forward, inevitably, to higher and higher views of life. But this is being drastically undermined today. Many point to the evidence of an evolutionary crisis, somewhat tarnishing the comfortable image of inevitable progress with man at the center of the stage. And some are even predicting the extinction of the whole human species, and we'll look at some of these things tomorrow. But the point is, the whole discussion of futurology and where man is going had made drastic inroads to the belief in a comfortable progress towards a better age. The belief in inevitable progress is not supported by the evidence of the past, nor is it corroborated by a present situation, and it's certainly not the united scenario of futurology. This means that optimistic humanism is more and more an ideology and less an empirical belief. It's held because they need to believe it, not because it's founded on the facts. The third pillar is the belief in the positive value of science as a guide to human progress and the provider of an alternative to both religion and morals. For example, they said, evolution is good. Therefore, evolution provides us with morals with which we can work as we go into the future. What happens was the very process of change became absolutized and it became dangerous. For example, one of the forces of evolution, if it's true, is that it builds towards unity. But if this is so, and you make the drive towards unity a value in itself, then you have no argument against totalitarianism. Because totalitarianism is the essential drive towards unity. And there's no argument against this. So many of these people began to see they were taking from evolution values which, if applied in other areas, were highly dangerous and extremely double-edged. You can see the early views like this in Huxley's writing or in the writings of Teilhard de Chardin. But in more and more areas today, people are seeing that science is reaching what they call a point of destructive returns. In other words, it's not just positive, there are also the negative fallout. And the attempt to use evolution as a basis for morals and ethics is a total failure. Bertrand Russell is typical of a growing group today who admit that science is no more than neutral and does not speak directly into the area of moral choice or what has to be done with it. The fourth pillar of optimistic humanism is the belief in man. And here, above all, the most persistent erosion of man's view of himself is occurring. The fact that man has made so many significant scientific discoveries points strongly to the significance of man. Yet the content of those same scientific discoveries heavily underscores his insignificance. And with his new knowledge, man finds himself dwarfed by the vast stretches of space and belittled by the long reaches of time. And the humanists are caught in a strange dilemma. If they affirm the greatness of man, it's only at the expense of ignoring his aberrations. But if they regard the human aberrations seriously, what do they do with them? Well, they either have to escape the dilemma, either by blaming the situation on God. And isn't it strange how many people who strongly affirm the non-existence of God have an equal propensity to affirm or to question his goodness? In other words, if you deny God's there, you have no right to pull him in to blame. Or else they reduce man to the point of insignificance where his aberrations are no longer a problem. For example, during World War II, Einstein, who was plagued by man's monstrosity to man, used to mutter to himself when he was really caught by the dilemma, "After all, this is only a small star." In other words, what is man? You can reduce the moral problem if you reduce the scale of man. But you can't have it both ways. You can't have a great man and also regard his aberrations. He escaped the dilemma of man's crime and evil, but only at the price of undermining his significance. The supreme characteristic of men today is the high degree of dissatisfaction with their own views of themselves. For example, there's a growing opposition to determinism. Not because determinism explains nothing, but because it explains too much. And it's a clutching constriction of what man feels himself to be. Arthur Koestler attacks determinism as ratomorphic, because it reduces man to the level of the rat. Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychologist, describes it as modern nihilism, removing the human values. And Noam Chomsky, the MIT scientist, describes it as the flat earth view of man. If any of you have read Mortimer Adler's book, The Difference of Man and the Difference It Makes, it's a fantastic book in this area. And he warns that if man continues to recognize no fundamental difference between himself and the animals, then he will slowly treat his fellow man more and more like a machine or an animal. And finally, anything left of contemporary morality or identity will be reduced to the level of the illusory, and the implications for individuals and civilization is very far-reaching. In other words, they can say, man, 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 but what is man? The modern views of man in psychology and science and so on are undermining the very aspirations of which they're speaking so loud. In other words, in each of those four areas, reason, progress, science, and man, although optimistic humanism speaks and appeals to the highest of man's aspirations and his goals, it ignores the full reality of his aberrations and it fails to provide a basis for the former. Of course, by contrast, pessimistic humanism majors on man's aberrations, his alienations, and allows little place for the aspirations. So the optimist finds himself in a peculiar dilemma. He subscribes in what he calls a rational faith in man. And yet this is increasingly hard to substantiate. It's no evidence. In other words, it's irrational. This very irrationality should make it anathema to the rational humanist. But he cannot discard it as a belief, because otherwise there would be nothing left of optimistic humanism. Perhaps the reason, unconsciously, that Nietzsche developed his concept of the Superman was to compensate for what he realized very strongly was his own weakness of character. Similarly, I think there's a very real danger that when the crunch comes and optimistic humanism begins to fail in the sense that man does not achieve the solution of his problems, the men who escape the temptation to pessimism will maybe succumb to another temptation, the opposite one, of creating a new technological Superman as a last-bid desperate attempt to solve those problems. Now as you look back, it's interesting to notice that it's a strange but undeniable fact that optimistic humanism generally appeals to only a very small sector of society. For example, in the Athens of Pericles, it was only a slave-based population that allowed the intellectuals time for reflection. The Italian Renaissance in Florence and Urbino and so on was not at all broadly based and was really confined to a very, very small circle, generally speaking the court circles and those that they brought in with the money they had to produce the art and so on they wanted. During the Enlightenment, the philosophers, the philosophes, were generally from the privileged, if not the aristocratic classes. And you can also see this today among the optimistic humanists. There was a fascinating article in the Humanist magazine in 1964 entitled, What's Wrong with Humanism? And it was an article written by a long-time humanist who complained that modern humanism was clinically detached from life. He urged, among other things, the fact that they should have a religious humanist movement with its own Bible, humanist hymns, and liturgy. Because he said that to the world outside the rarefied air of academic scientific circles, such beliefs were too dry and uninspiring. I wonder if any more ironic and damning, fatal accusation could be leveled at humanism than the stinging charge that it is not a sufficiently human way of life. Certainly I'm making a value judgment now, but it's difficult to avoid the strong suspicion that optimistic humanism only gains its high view of man by borrowing from the Christian heritage of the culture around it. It's fascinating that Thomas Huxley used to sing hymns on Sunday nights with his agnostic friends whenever he was particularly melancholy. It's another heavy irony of history that waning Victorian Christianity should have lost the struggle against humanism, but yet have succeeded in imposing on its enemies, the humanists, its own smug ethics. But beyond the waning of Christianity's own beliefs, These ethics not only went on, but have been elevated into principles by the humanists. In other words, optimistic humanism, like Marxism, is really a Christian heresy, borrowing from the Christianity its high view of man. Marxism, whatever it says in propaganda, betrays the value of man in practice because it elevates the state as an absolute over the individual. Optimistic humanism does the same in a different area, with its stress on the aspirations, but silence concerning the alienations. Time alone will show whether the humanists are really parasitical or have a genuine moral solvency. More and more people are saying that optimistic humanism only succeeded as a parasite on the Christian views of man, which were in the culture which they themselves rejected. Of course, the question then comes, if the basis of optimistic humanism is so weak, why wasn't this exposed long ago? And the answer lies in understanding the mid-Victorian mood of general self-congratulation to which humanism was born, because a complacent smugness was widely prevalent. I'm afraid this is true of the church too. Both Roman Catholic and the Protestant circles exuded a kind of rare coziness of orthodoxy. But this was very much true of secular atheism. Both, all of them, believed that civilization would expel the last traces of barbarism even from the memory. And the 19th century was characterized by a belief that the 20th century would be the fulfillment of all their hopes. And the general social stability that they knew in their own time gave a certain credibility to this myth which arose. In other words, men like Nietzsche and so on saw the problem before. But in the day of general optimism and total social stability, it's not unnatural that no one else saw the problem. Of course, 20th century upheavals have cruelly blown this apart, hard on the heels of World War I, and you can hardly imagine now, with our apocalyptic age, how drastic and calamitous World War I was to them, with their cozy views of the future. It just blew it apart cruelly. Hard on the heels of World War I came the Russian Revolution, followed by the Depression, and then World War II. With lightning speed, the three great 19th century European empires of Russia, Germany, and Austria disappeared overnight, later to be followed by the British Empire. And with the emergence on top of this of communism and the acceleration of modern technology, two new explosive forces were unleashed into the modern world. And you can see the whole picture has just drastically changed in just 20 odd years. The very fabric of civilization seemed torn apart. But the point was, it was at times like this, the social eruptions, when suddenly pessimism surfaced in the sense that people saw reality as it was, and optimistic humanism really faltered. People were forced to face the logic of their bankruptcy of base, and they accurately perceived the tenuousness of the optimism's brave hopes. If they were optimistic in the good times, they tended to be overmistic in dark times, but the latter were the moments of truth. Now, all this had been predicted before by the devil's party. For example, Nietzsche, many people have said that the 20th century is really just one long historical cultural footnote in what Nietzsche wrote. Nietzsche had seen modern Europe falling into abyss. And in the 1880s, Nietzsche prophetically warned, "We have entered the classical age of war." He said, "There will be wars such as never happened on earth." And this is what he saw coming, but people just laughed at him. After World War I, a similar point was seized on by Franz Kafka. He said, "The buttresses of human existence are collapsing. Historical development is no longer determined by the individual, but by the masses. And we're being shoved, rushed, swept away. We're the victims of history." And it's interesting that since then, any events powerful in social disruption, such as the two world wars, have had the same effect of tearing away the social fabric and exposing the reality beneath. It's interesting, in the case of Western society, of course, the cancer underneath had already been diagnosed by the pessimistic humanists. But the point now, and this is why Sartre calls this the striptease of humanism, it has taken this last decade, the 60s, to provide the most sober moment of truth for the optimistic humanists. In other words, the First World War came, certain people despaired. Second World War came, the Depression and so on, and certain other people despaired. But it's taken the 60s to drive the point home on a far, far wider level. Arthur Koestler has described the 60s as the age of climax. and John Rader Platt as the hinge of history. In other words, the decade when all the momentous issues like the population explosion, ecology, the urban crisis, the racial situation, the arms race, etc., 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 suddenly have been seen as exponential curves rising sharply. And they've seen that man, far from being in the center of the stage, is really with his back to the wall, fighting for existence at all. And you must add to all these things I just mentioned the obvious shame arising from the contemptuous dismissal of Western humanism by the Third World. In other words, we're no longer looked up to in the West, but scorned and derided because of our humanism. As Fanon again says, leave this Europe, where they're never done talking of man, yet murder men everywhere they find them. And Fanon warns his Third World fellow revolutionaries that the United States, which he calls that super-European monstrosity, he warns them, the United States, quote, is a horror in which the taints, the sickness, and the inhumanity of Europe have grown to even more appalling dimensions. So you can see these various disruptions have come. And then the 60s, with all these mounting problems, have just forced man to see he can't do it. And added to this, Western humanism feels isolated as the rest of the world scorns it for its betrayal of man. If the social disruptions had not come, maybe the stability might have continued longer. But it would have been an Indian summer. The disruptions would have come eventually. And there's every indication that disruption may be at our elbow daily as this century closes. In other words, in this climate, the subterranean pessimism surfaces, the devil's party surfaces, and speaks more prophetically and appeals much more popularly because it accurately portrays modern anxiety, loneliness, alienation, and dread. Maybe a description of Thomas Mann could be an epitaph for our era. Someone said of Thomas Mann, he died undecided, hesitating between a desperate optimism and a weary pessimism. This then is the striptease of humanism, a gathering crisis of optimism, an escape from reason, a surfacing of subterranean pessimism. Understanding it as the daily climate of our time, we can now analyze more closely certain features of its arrival and of its permanent residue. In other words, we're looking now at some of the aspects which we need to understand now that this crisis is here. First of all, two minor ones, and then we'll have a break and get into the heart of things. I think it'll be more interesting in the second half. First, in its arrival, there is a minor but a strong element of surprise. For anyone who'd read Nietzsche, there should never have been any surprise, but in fact there was. Back in 1929, Freud remarked in his Civilization and Discontent, man has, as it were, become a prosthetic god. Future ages will increase man's likeness to God even more. But present-day man, strangely, does not feel happy in his godlike character. In other words, God is dead and man is now come of age and is God, but somehow he's troubled and he's uneasy. In 51, Camus put it even more keenly. During the last century, man cast off the fetters of religion. But hardly was he free, however, when he created new and utterly intolerable chains. The kingdom of grace has been conquered, but the kingdom of justice is crumbling too, and Europe is dying of this deception. In other words, you have a situation pregnant with irony. There's not only a crisis of belief, there's a crisis of disbelief. On the one hand, some religious thinkers endlessly report to us the fact that God is dead, and certainly these liberals almost do this as their only creedal confession they have left. But to the atheist, the fact is no longer heroic. If the city of God has been razed to the ground, who is most in need of a home now? And who feels the chill most keenly? In other words, God is dead, man has come of age, but then they suddenly saw there was a surprise to it. All wasn't quite as well as they thought. There's the first element that you see creeping in, particularly in the poets and the writers. The second element, and think about this much more carefully, is the irreversibility of the logic of this. In other words, there's no going back if God is not there. It would be very comforting to regard the present pessimism just as a cycle or as a swing of the pendulum, but there are various reasons why we cannot just regard it as a cycle. For one thing, there are new factors which prevent us going back in another swing of the pendulum. And specifically, the new factor of all is technology. Here we come to the difference between Oswald Spengler and Max Weber as they looked at our own century. Spengler thought that the decline of the West was essentially what had happened before, because everything went round in historical cycles. Weber said that what was happening had never happened before. It was new, because although there were similar symptoms, the new factor was what he called the disenchantment of the world by technology. And this made the situation irreversible. In other words, technology, as Toffler calls it, is a great growling engine of change, which is now accelerating man onwards into his future. And if God is not there, there's no stopping. Others have pointed to a second reason why it's irreversible. Not just new factors like technology, but a certain logical inevitability, which flows from the diagnosis of the death of God as a cultural effect. Incidentally, people like Nietzsche did not actually say whether or not they felt God was dead. Nietzsche was making no statement, in other words, as to the metaphysical reality of God. What he was starting on was a cultural diagnosis. God was dead as regards culture and people was concerned, what we're calling the erosion of the Christian culture. Now he saw, though, clearly, that this means that certain things could never be the same again. This is the point he makes in his famous parable in the Gay Science. You know this parable where the madman enters the marketplace with a lantern in broad daylight, cries out, "I seek God, I seek God, where has he gone?" But the crowd just go around laughing and chattering, and they're totally unconcerned at his outbursts and his comical antics, and they laugh at him, and they say, suddenly he turns on them sharply, and he says, "Where has God gone? I'll tell you where he's gone. We have killed him, you and I. We are all his murderers." But they ignore the enormity of his announcement and laugh at him still. And finally he takes his lantern, he just throws it down on the ground, and he shouts out, "I come too early. My time has not come yet. This tremendous event is still on its way." In other words, the people of his day were too foolish to see the logic of what they'd done. This is the point of Nietzsche. The death of God goes far beyond the decline of religious belief. As Nietzsche says, the death of God is as if man has drunk up the sea and sponged away the entire horizon and unchained the very earth from the sun. God is dead, and God remains dead. And this means that all that for which God was once responsible must disappear too. And this terrible game must be played until the last throw of the dice is down. In other words, do you see it? In the world without God, man is not so much free as overwhelmingly responsible, because he has to be God. The English philosopher David Hume, who was terribly pessimistic at one stage in his life about his empiricism, said this as he'd removed God. "First of all, I'm frightened and confounded with that forlorn solitude which I'm placed by my philosophy." In other words, if God is dead, what you must see is there's an ominous significance, because man is totally free but by himself, which Sartre later called total responsibility in total solitude. This was the new definition of man's liberty without God. You see, if there's no God there, as Sartre says, for man to be man means to try to be God. But he cannot. So he's caught in this dualism of trying to be that which he cannot, and going round the cycle and falling on his face, and finding himself terribly lonely in the vacuum where there's no God. The humanists had claimed that they could retain Christian values and give them a validity independent of God. But Nietzsche dismissed this as impossible, since Christianity was the entire undergirding of Western civilization, not only of its religious beliefs, but also of its social values and its fundamental views of man. And Nietzsche diagnosed not progress, but a time of decadence, the logic of which was nihilism. As Nietzsche says, there remains only the void. Man is falling. His dignity is gone. His values are lost. There's no difference between up and down. It has become chilly, and a dark night is closing in. For those who would not face the desperate extremity of the truth that he exposed to them, Nietzsche had nothing but scorn. He agreed with Burckhardt in hating what he called the odious windbags of progressive optimism, people who refused to look over the abyss when God was no longer. As he said, if God is dead, and as yet no new God lies in the cradle and the swaddling clothes, it's his quote, "there is no alternative except to face the nihilism, and from the ashes of nihilism to try and get all you could and gain what he called the will to power, which was to create the new Superman." Of course, a lot of people ignored this diagnosis as mere poetry, and they ignored Nietzsche. But let me just look at one aspect, and we'll break after this, one aspect, and see how practical he was or not. The aspect is, does the death of God really relate, for example, to anything practical? And specifically here, we'll look at totalitarianism. The death of God related to totalitarianism. Now, of course, there are many other factors behind modern totalitarianism. And even if this is a Christian culture, we'd have to face this issue very squarely. What I'm just trying to point out is that several thinkers see that some of the factors behind it are inevitable because of the death of God. From several different viewpoints, it has been cogently argued that modern totalitarianism is closely connected to the death of God and the loss of the absolutes. I'll just show you three men. Nietzsche, who has hated Christianity. Camus, who didn't hate Christianity but was an existentialist and an atheist. And Dostoevsky, who was a Christian. Three men from very different viewpoints. All of them saw that if God was dead, there's an inevitable logic to the fact of totalitarianism. First, Nietzsche. Nietzsche argued that with God dead, man would be too weak to live without the rules. And so inevitably the state, which he called the new idol, would be set up as an arbitrary absolute because God, the true absolute, was gone. And what would happen would be that the state would force men to serve the state instead of God. In other words, when equality is confused with conformity, there'd be no initiative left and the general leveling would lead to socialism, which he hated. At best, for Nietzsche, socialism was only a Christian sentiment in a weak secular disguise, and at worst, socialism was just totalitarianism, perpetuating the slavery of man in the name of the state, not God. And Nietzsche saw no alternative if God was dead. Secondly, Dostoevsky, Christian, starting from a very different position, but ending up at the same point. Dostoevsky argues that freedom with no form is bound to result in the reaction of form with no freedom. I don't know if any of you read The Possessed. In The Possessed, which is his blistering and prophetic expose of nihilism, one of the revolutionaries, Shigalov, admits the unfortunate conclusion of his vision of the new socialist society. I'll quote. He says, "I've become so entangled in my own data and my conclusions that they directly contradict my original premises. I started out," and this sounds like a sentence from Schaeffer, "I started out with the idea of unrestricted freedom, and I have arrived at unrestricted despotism." Shigalov's system, as you see it, in other words, ends up where one-tenth of the world have individual freedom and full rights, but they have that over the remaining nine-tenths. And the remaining nine-tenths lose their individuality and become something like a herd of cattle. He, too, saw latter-day 20th century socialism as a kind of secular Tower of Babel, tightening a strict totalitarian control. Freedom without form leads to form without freedom. And without God, there was no alternative. Camus in the 20th century takes a third position, but equally strong. Camus, and this is in The Rebel, argues that modern egalitarianism, the attempt to make all men equal, politically and economically before the state, is the secularization of the soul's original equality before God. In other words, the Christian view, you didn't need to make all men equal in this life, because manifestly they weren't. But they're all equal in value before God, back of this life. But if there's no God, then you have to make them equal here and now. So Camus says, I quote, "Totality is, in effect, nothing other than the ancient dream of unity common to believers and rebels, now projected horizontally onto an earth deprived of God." In other words, unless you're to say there is no equality, you must say there must be equality, and since there's none in the afterlife, you've got to have it now. Not only politically, but economically. And it ends up with a rigid state control. And so all of these three men, despite entirely different premises, are each convinced that in the world after the death of God, the rise of modern totalitarianism is not accidental nor cyclical, but logically inevitable. For Nietzsche, the death of God means that man is disastrously limited. For Dostoevsky, it means that man is disastrously unlimited. For Camus, it means that if God dies, so does diversity's place within unity. But for all of them, freedom is gone. Remember, Dostoevsky said, "God is dead, everything is permitted." And Nietzsche said, "The advantage of our times is, nothing is true, everything is permitted." Both were saying the same thing, that if God is dead, relativism is true. Both were consistent in seeing the inevitable logic of relativism. But Dostoevsky was the more human. For Nietzsche to be consistent, he needed to become his own Superman. But his views were overwhelming, even for himself. And as Nietzsche was poised over the abyss he saw, he shivered with what he called the horror of being responsible for everything alive.